Welcome to the podcast To Be Named Later, where we explore the world a conversation at a time. Sit back and enjoy. Here are your hosts, Chris and Kelly.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the podcast To Be Named Later. I've got my co-host, Chris, and we have a special guest for part of the podcast. Keeping in the family, we have a niece of mine and a cousin to Christopher, Misty. Welcome, Misty and Chris.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Chris, how about you?
Doing great, buddy.
Great. Misty came and has had some life experiences that we just wanted to share. We're not offering medical advice, and everybody has a different journey in life, but Misty has some interesting stories and perspective to share, and thought it'd be interesting for others to hear a little bit about her story. Misty, when you were 19, you're now 43, so 24 years ago, you'd been living the typical life, just finished up high school in Southern California, and then you got some medical news. Do you want to start telling us a little bit about your journey?
Sure. So I was 19, and I just kind of out of nowhere, I mean, there's a little backstory. I had an unusually dark stool, and that set the whole thing off to where I went to the doctor, and they did some labs, and within 2 days, I was at work, and my stepmom was there, and she said, "Get in the car. We have to go to the hospital now." And I naturally thought something was wrong with someone else or my dad, and she said, "It's you," and I was like, "Whoa, hold on." So... long story short, there, after a week in the hospital, I was diagnosed with autoimmune hepatitis, which means that I have hepatitis simply means that your liver is inflamed. It doesn't work right. And I had not been a drinker. I was only 19. And autoimmune means that my own body sees my liver as a foreign object and thus has been, you know, mounting attacks against it for who knows how long. And by age 19, I had full-blown cirrhosis.
So, again, you're told you have to go to the hospital, and first you think it's, you know, somebody else, and you find out it's you. What was going through your mind when you first hear this news?
I was really confused, I think. Although, after the dark stool, I noticed symptoms outside of that. Like, I was having trouble. I had a lot of fatigue. And I noticed that, like, I remember distinctly going to the mall with my friends and getting winded just walking the distance of the mall and having to slow down and take a break. And it was really unusual because, I mean, up until this point, I'd been just a normal kid. So I think I was confused, but kind of was like, oh, okay, so I need some kind of medication or something. And I just figured it was going to be, you know, in and out, they'll fix it, and I'm done.
I want to fast forward, Misty, 24 years, and then we'll circle back, but where are you today?
Today I am, I mean, you know, I can't ever really say healthy. I'm relatively healthy. I'm stable. I have 2 children. I work a part-time job. And I do just about everything that I would like to do. I mean, I have some restrictions in that a common symptom of liver disease is just fatigue. So I get really tired really easily. Like if we were to go to an amusement park, I could walk around and do that all day. It would just be exhausting.
So from 19 to 43, there's been quite a journey. And you told me that once a week, even today, you have to go have fluid removed, correct?
Yes.
And how much fluid is that a week?
It can vary quite a lot. it kind of goes in spurts to where it's not not too much, but then it just kind of it changes. What I have noticed for myself over the years is it kind of tends to hover in a certain range as far as the amount, and it stays there for a while, and then it starts to fluctuate and it changes. So the last several, it's called a paracentesis, the procedure. The last several I've had, they've removed about like an average of 3 liters of fluid from my abdomen.
So that's a lot.
It is a lot.
That must add a lot. Your weight, just, I mean, liquids are, water, I think, is 8 pounds a gallon.
Yep. It is heavy. It has caused me 2 umbilical hernias. 3. I've had 2 repairs. I have a third. And I name them because, you know, then I have somewhere to direct my frustration, I guess. But it's heavy, and it really makes it difficult to breathe is really my biggest thing. And then also, of course, vanity.
So going back, when you first were diagnosed and you started to explore things, at one point in this journey, liver transplants were explored for you, correct?
Yep. That was when it would have been around 2012, and I was, the process started, and I was taken off the active list in about 2015 or 16.
So tell us a little bit more about that process of getting on a transplant list, just from your perspective, how it works, what you learned, and just what kind of went through your mind.
It's rigorous. So there's a lot of different specialists that you have to see. They do, you know, you have to have your blood work done. They do ultrasounds. They do CT scans. You have to meet with a dietitian. You have to meet with a psychologist, and of course your hepatologist, your liver doctor, as well as surgeons. And they all, you know, do their tests. They ask their questions. They do their things. And the things they're looking for is, are you a viable candidate? How complicated of a surgery is this going to be? Obviously, it's complicated to begin with, but what makes your case unique or different than others? Do you have a very good, solid support system? Because you will need help. Do you know good nutrition? Do you understand that you will have to take medication for the rest of your life? You know, those types of things. And then they talk to you about what they found and all these things. And then the biggest factor in putting you on the transplant list is what is called your MELD score. And that stands for it's very encouraging, the Model for End-Stage Liver Disease score. And so the scale for that ranges from 6 to 40. 6 is you're doing fine. Yeah, your liver isn't working correctly, but you're functioning well. 40 is you need a transplant in the next week or you're probably not going to make it. And so once they've compiled all this information, they take your MELD score and they submit it to UNOS, which is it's the body who decides where organs go. And based on your score, you're put on a list. And one interesting thing I learned through that whole process is there's not one list. There's actually, in the United States, there's 6. And so it goes by region. And so essentially it's like whoever has the highest score gets the liver that's available, provided it's a good match. And to be honest, the matching process is not as difficult as people think for a liver. Really, my blood type is A negative. I can accept an organ from anyone who has any A or O blood type. So that was surprising to me. And then to maintain your active status on the list, there's follow-ups that have to be done. Based on your MELD score, you have to have labs done periodically, and it changes depending on your score. You have to have ultrasounds and CT scans done periodically to maintain your status on the list.
Do you know when you were on the list how close to getting a transplant you ever were at, like, the closest?
Yeah, I was next.
And what happened that you, why did, what happened?
Right. So, my story is also a little more complicated because I had, during this part of my life where I had the worst symptoms and the worst issues due to this hepatitis, we moved. I lived in Colorado, and then we moved to Wisconsin. And the reason we moved is because I couldn't take care of my kids. I needed help. But in the process, then there was some confusion and some mix-up. And what was happening is my MELD was relatively low, but I was having a lot of other symptoms that were more emergent than my MELD reflected. And when you have a patient in that situation, your doctors can petition the UNOS board and ask, can you give exception points? Because this lab score is not accurate to how this patient is functioning. And so I was getting a fair amount of exception points. And I was to the point where my doctor called me and said, do you have your arrangements in place? Because the next liver that comes in and it's a match is yours. And I said, yeah. Then, unbeknownst to me, they kind of put me on hold and reviewed my case and came back to me a little while later and said, UNOS is not going to give us the exception points anymore because you're too healthy, which is a good problem to have. And in that moment, I had like a mixture of like disappointment and fear and relief, because I wasn't convinced that I was ready. So it was a really strange experience, but that's what transpired once I was in that position on the list. And that is not the case for everybody.
So I just want to follow up on a couple of things there. You said that you weren't able to take care of your kids. Was it the fatigue and such, or without going into too many details, but what kind of circumstances did you find yourself in that meant you couldn't take care of your kids?
I would say the biggest issue was the fatigue. Also, the health systems are very different from where we live to where we live now. And we have a really good program here where I can go get that fluid drained off every week. But it wasn't the same in Colorado. And so I was functioning most of the time with a lot of fluid. And it's exhausting. So that was a struggle. And on top of that, I had a great deal of pain, but not, it wasn't internal pain. It was because of the weight, because of the fatigue, and because, you know, just trying to like power through everything and live my life as normally as possible. My body was just tired and hurting. And there was a really long period where I had my second child, and I didn't know that you could retain this fluid. And so for a long time, I just thought it was baby weight. Well, then I realized, no, this is something different. And they told me, and I started getting it taken off, but it would accumulate again. And then I'm right back where I started. And somewhere in the midst of that also, that fluid, it's called a spontaneous bacterial peritoneal infection. And that fluid became infected somehow, which was really probably, I've had two natural childbirths, and I think that pain was still worse. So I just had a lot of ongoing symptoms that were causing, that were just making things really hard. And then when you have like a 6-year-old and a brand new baby, It's a lot.
So something you said to me is striking, and I'm curious if you have a perspective on this. You were diagnosed with this situation when you were 19, mm-hmm. and had at least one child, if not two, and it sounds like no one told you that you could accumulate this fluid?
No. No. So, my first pregnancy went off without a hitch. I mean, relatively speaking. I mean, given my circumstances, my first pregnancy was great. My second one is where things got haywire and, I started gaining weight and feeling bloated, but that you hear pregnant women going through that all the time. So I didn't really think much of it. And it was about 4 weeks after my son was born when I wasn't losing the fluid that I went to my hepatologist. I said, something is wrong. And he took one look at me and he said, yeah, let's get that drained.
What was your immediate reaction?
I said, you can do that? And he said, yeah. I said, please, let's do that.
So this kind of leads to another area that I'm curious about your philosophy and perspective. And again, there's all sorts of, beliefs in medical information and one size doesn't fit all, but it sounds like in some ways you certainly weren't given all the information you should have been early on. Has that or other areas caused you to explore more than just what we would think of here as traditional Western medicine?
100%. However, it wasn't the incident about the fluid, because I don't know how I never learned that, because long before that ever happened, I spent a lot of hours researching and learning what I could about health, how to maintain health, about your liver function and how it works and what it does and things you can do to improve your overall health, as well as, keep your body functioning well. And the catalyst for that was, ironically, it was after my first son was born. I was in the hospital, not unrelated to his birth. And I was 26. And because we lived away from family, my husband was not with me. I was at the hospital alone. And they did an ultrasound, and I had a doctor very casually come into the room and say to me, so we got your ultrasound results, everything, it looks pretty good, but there's just this one spot. It's probably cancer, but we're going to do a biopsy just to make sure. And then he just kind of left. And I was like, what did you just say to me? What? I was terrified. I'm like, I'm 26, and I was freaking out.
So the doctor basically walked in the room, gave you, in some ways, not to be overly dramatic, but a potential death sentence, and left?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And it clicked during that hospital stay, because there was another incident that happened, too, that it was like, hold on. If I really want to take care of myself and I really want to maximize my life, it's on me. 100% it's on me. And so I just dove in head first and I started reading, and the internet was, it was around. It wasn't as good of a resource as it is now, but I was using that, and I learned a lot about alternative methods and alternative things you can do. And probably the thing that I think has had the biggest impact is diet. And I will say, I don't eat a perfect diet. I definitely don't. I don't eat very much processed food, because I really truly think that that was a contributing factor to how I ended up where I am in the first place. And there's like no nutrient value for your body in there. And so what am I really gaining by eating this? Nothing. And in fact, I'm making my liver work harder, because it's also full of a bunch of chemicals that don't occur in natural foods. So that's where I focused a lot of my energy. But naturally, in that research, I also learned about other types of treatments. I have seen a holistic doctor. I use chiropractic regularly. I use essential oils daily. And I try to do what works for me, and I can't tell anybody else what works for them, but and I know I need Western medicine. It's not always my first choice, and I ask a lot of questions, because I want to understand what is happening, why do you think I need this medicine, what are my treatment options, because I feel like I have enough knowledge that if you can explain to me where the dysfunction is, I can also try some things that I know and maybe not be on such a heavy dose of medicine or be on it at all. And so that's really shaped where my philosophy as far as how to truly take care of my health.
What are some of the skills or, I guess, protection mechanisms you put in place when you're searching? You said the internet. Well, as we all know, the internet's kind of the wild frontier. Mm-hmm. When you're searching for this information, what are some of those skills that you've developed over the years to figure out even then, you know, which things are reasonable and which are fly-by-night scam or whatever other term you want to use that should be avoided? How do you sure. balance that? I need other knowledge sources with they still need to be credible. What are the skills that you've developed?
Sure, that's a great question. I have some reliable sources that I've used, you know, repeatedly over time. And I think one thing that I've done too is, you know, it's funny, you can look in medical journals and things like that, and you can read about testing and things that were done with unconventional medicines and the results, and they can even be really good results, but they don't use them. And so I learned a lot about liver function. I learned a lot about the problems that hepatitis causes. I learned a lot about ways to detoxify your body naturally and things like that, through somewhat in medical journals. Also, like I said, I had some books that I depended on. There was a great book called, it's a cookbook, but it was a fantastic book, and it talked in depth about how our foods that we have, that we go to the market and buy today, are not nearly the same. Even a very, like a fresh apple is not the same as the apple that my grandparents ate or their parents ate, because we've depleted our soil of nutrients so much. So that cookbook was a great resource, because not only did it have recipes, it gave me the background information to understand why this food, how it could help me and how to treat it, and also what to look for when I buy food. You know, people say food is medicine, and I totally buy into that. So that cookbook was one great resource. And by and large, I'll be honest, people would probably think that some of the resources I used were snake oil and things like that, because it's unconventional. But I always would look at the credentials of, you know, the person who wrote the book or the person running the website or writing the article, you know, and that would tell me a lot. And then also I rely on my gut.
Since you've been involved in this arena and health situation for, you know, almost a quarter of a century, do you feel that the medical profession and the way that they understand the issue or provide patient care or look at other approaches, have you seen changes in that over that period of time?
Without a doubt, I have. There, you know, it's in a lot of ways, doctors, they do want to do their best, but I think in the past, doctors were very used to, I'm going to tell a patient to do this, and they're going to do that, and that's going to be the end of it. And So initially, when I started investigating all of this and learning about it for myself and asking a lot of questions, there was visible frustration with me on my doctor's parts. There was a clear, like, I'm the doctor here, so I don't know why you're asking me all these questions. That's changed dramatically. I also have noticed that most physicians that I see have a lot more respect for my choices than they used to. It's been a very long time since I felt pressured to take a medicine or do a procedure or anything that that I wasn't totally comfortable with. So there's just a whole lot more openness, and I think that's a reflection of you can look around our culture and see that there's kind of like a shift in that part of our lives as far as health and true health and nurturing your health. So I think that the openness of the doctors now is just a reflection of that.
You've talked about a family. You have a husband. You have two children. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a significant part of your life, and I'm sure their lives. How have you handled that, and especially at times when you were more ill, and how have you balanced that with being a mom and a wife and involving your children and husband in this situation?
Sure. My husband has always been incredibly supportive, and he takes a vested interest in my health. And, you know, if I want to make a change or make a decision that is going to affect some, you know, the rest of our family, we talk about it. We come to a decision together. I think my husband is like, he signed on for this. And so whatever he needs to do is what he's going to do. We knew that I was sick when we got married. I think he just does his very, very best that he possibly can to support me. And there's days when I work and I come home and I say, I am not cooking dinner tonight. And he says, okay, we'll take, don't worry about it. You know, things like that. We're also religious people, I guess you could say. I mean, we're Christians, and so prayer has played a big part in that. It's also our church family in Colorado was a great support while we lived there for my husband and I, as well as our kids. And as far as my kids go, I'm very open with my children. As much as they can handle. Like, I'm not going to sit down with my 5-year-old and go, I have an illness that's going to, you know, that I'm going to die from someday. Because number one, I don't truly believe that I'm going to die from this. And number two, that's terrifying for a child. So within reason, I've always been as open as I possibly can with my kids. And there was a time when I had to have a serious talk with my older child about a transplant and what that meant. And I remember distinctly thinking to myself, he understands that in order for me to live, someone else will die. But I don't think it ever really clicked with him until he was older that the reverse was also true. That if someone didn't die to give me a liver, then I would die. So I don't know at what point that clicked for him, because it doesn't come up a lot in our day-to-day life. But they're very aware. They know I go for my weekly paracentesis. They know on days when I'm tired and exhausted and I don't have it in me. I think my little guy, he's almost 11, he gets frustrated with me because, I mean, he's 11, he's bouncing off the walls and I just don't have it in me. But he also understands, you know, and we've sat down and had conversations about this is what I have and this is what it means. I never want to create an atmosphere where my kids are in the dark. I don't want them to be scared to ask me questions. I don't want them to be afraid of what's going to happen to me. And I want them to know that I'm an open book and I'm a source of knowledge for you, like as you're growing up and as you're navigating your own medical stuff and becoming grown and having illnesses or whatever of your own, you know, just a cold or whatever, I am a resource for you. And so I think just that openness, I think that's really healthy for kids. And what I've learned over the years is kids can handle a lot more than we think they can.
Someplace, you know, there's another Misty who is 19 today, learning that they have something similar to what you have, whether it's the liver situation or something else, but kind of learning that maybe the life they expected is going to have a curve that they certainly didn't think of when they were 18 or, you know, the day before they learned about it at that age. What would you say to that person, you know, with the wisdom and experience you've gained over the last 24 years that maybe you wish you had known or learned or just someone else had told you when you were 19 and first encountering the situation?
I would say a few things. First, I would say know your people. Because some people don't handle this kind of stuff. Like, it freaks them out and they aren't interested in having anything to do with you. And while I think that's a little bit naive, I also understand and they're not going to be helpful. So know the people you have that you can count on. Know who's there so that if someday you just want to cry and scream, it's not fair, you have somebody to do that with, right? And then the other thing I would say is you are your own advocate. If you don't learn about this, sure, they'll do their best for you. They'll do what they can, your doctors will, and surely anybody that is your people will also help you do the best they can for you. But unless you educate yourself and unless you know yourself and your body and how it functions and how you feel and how you could feel and what could be a problem and what couldn't, you're not doing yourself any favors. You really have to take the time to educate yourself and ask questions. Ask questions. So if someone tells you, you know, this medication works because it flushes fluid from your abdomen and, you know, that, but it does affect your potassium. Well, how does it affect my potassium? And how can I make sure that I'm getting enough? And what do I do about this? Or what do I do about that? And know what your side effects could be. You just have to know. You have to educate yourself so that you can be your own advocate with your doctors. And you, the other really key piece is, and it's hard, especially when you're really young, right? Don't be intimidated. It's your body. You have a say. You can ask for what you want. And you can refuse services should you choose. And I'm not saying anybody should or should not based on their situation. I don't know. But you have to feel comfortable with what you're doing and know that you are in control. A doctor works for you, not the other way around.
Great. Not to get too much into this, but I am just curious. You said that you go once a week to get this fluid removed. Is that a painful process, or what's the basic logistics of that like?
Sure. So I will just try to give you like an overview. First, they use an ultrasound machine to, you know, make sure it's there, and it is, and they decide where is going to be the best point of entrance to get that fluid out. And then they use lidocaine, a local anesthetic, and they inject that, and that hurts. Sometimes it hurts worse than others. It stings, you know, it's just like a, and if you've ever had like a shot at the dentist, same thing, it's the same stinging. But it's temporary. And then they use a catheter, a needle with a hole in it and a catheter inside. So it's a metal needle with a plastic catheter in it. And they insert that into the wall of the abdomen.
and then the metal needle comes out, the plastic catheter stays, and it has small holes throughout it. And then they attach a tube to a machine that has suction, and it sucks the fluid out. And towards the end, I got to roll around and push on things, and I've learned over the years where the spots are that it likes to accumulate and not try to go out, and wiggle around, and once it stops flowing and you've done all your, you know, poking and prodding and there's nothing else coming out, they just pull it out, put a Band-Aid on it, and call it a day.
About how long does the process take?
Definitely depends on the amount of fluid, but it can be like 45 minutes to an hour and a half. It's not very long.
And what do you do during that? Read or listen to music?
Well, I've been going to the same lab to have this procedure done for, how long has it been? 8 years? So I'm friends with everybody there. So we chit-chat, and then if they don't have time, if they're busy with other patients, then I usually will. I'm obsessed with cooking and food, so I'll read recipes, I'll watch cooking videos, or stuff like that, just kind of waste time on my phone because there's not really anything else I can do.
Misty, you talked about a cookbook that you found helpful. I wanted to make sure to get the name and author for our podcast listeners.
Sure. The book is called Nourishing Traditions. It was written by Sally Fallon, F-A-L-L-O-N. What I found to be really helpful about the cookbook is it was unlike most cookbooks where it just gives you a bunch of recipes and maybe tells a little backstory. It goes into great detail about how to select your foods and why you want to select the things you want to select. So it talks about healthy proteins. It talks about, it even addresses if you are looking for a healthy choice, it gives you your best choice, it gives you your not so good choices, and it also gives you compromise choices in some areas. It talks about the different effects of proteins on your body, of fats on your body. It talks about fermented foods, and it runs the gamut, and it's not just recipe. It's very thorough, in-depth explanation about why these recipes are beneficial.
I like that, where it kind of gives you some of the choices within choices, if you will.
Mm-hmm. It's very helpful.
Misty, you've talked a lot about the process that you've gone through, the learnings and things like that. I know we'd love to learn a little bit more about kind of some of the learnings you've had and the actual things you've done or are doing. And I'd like to toss it off to my co-host, Chris, to chat with you a little bit more about that.
Sure.
Hey, Misty.
Hi.
You know, you and I have had conversations in the past. I know you've helped me in the past. You've done a lot of the legwork, you know, a lot of it obviously out of necessity, and you're really knowledgeable. You've spent the time and put in the effort to learn about you know, some of the alternatives, man. A lot of people don't know that you know, some of the alternatives out there are very effective, and a lot of times we go to the doctor and we're given like a single choice, like this is the path you need to take, this is my recommendation, but you know, that's their choice, right? And at the end of the day, like you've stated, it's your body, you get to decide. I was hoping maybe you could expound a little bit on, you know, it's just some of the different things. I know you said diet was really important, but I know there's other things that you've done you know, to help keep yourself as healthy as you can, and I was hoping maybe you can kind of talk about those a little bit.
Sure. In all honesty, I've dabbled in a lot, and we also have to come at this from a very realistic perspective, which is I have a limited budget. So, like, some of the things that I would really like to explore further or learn more about or do even more of, sometimes they're cost prohibitive. So I've tried to focus my energies on the things that I can do. And so when I was doing the initial research for, I made a binder. I called it my Healthy Liver Book, and I collected a bunch of information about how the liver functions, what causes it to be dysfunctional, and the various systems in your body that can contribute to that going awry. And so I've tried Like I said, I use chiropractic regularly, and there's a very simple reason. Inside your spinal cord is all of your nerve tissue, like your central nervous system that tells your body what to do. It sends signals back and forth between your body and your brain. And so it's quite logical, really, when you think about your vertebrae. If they're crooked, there's undue stress and pressure on your spinal cord, and then it mixes up the signals. So it makes sense to me, like, why would I not keep that functioning, you know, as well as possible, so that everything is doing everything it's supposed to do. Another thing that I've learned a lot about is, I remember early on coming across some information about it in my research, which is essential oils, but at the time, you know, I didn't know, one thing I knew for sure is that you had to have good quality, and I didn't know how to find that out. And I knew that I could find essential oils at some health food stores, but they were very expensive. And I also didn't really know what oils I would need or how to use them. So that ended up coming full circle later on in my life. I met someone and I've learned a great deal about essential oils and how they can affect your body and the profound benefits that they can have on your body. If they're good quality. I've also tried Ayurvedic medicine, which is more of like, it's definitely like more of an Eastern approach, to where it approaches your body as a whole. And it involves like some, meditative practices and those types of things. And so I kind of dabble in a bunch of different stuff, and it by and large is dictated by what I feel is helpful, what I can afford, and what is practical. And the one thing, and I know it sounds like beating a dead horse, but the one thing that really fits into all those categories really, really easily and simply is food. And when I started to learn about how your body processes food, that was like a no-brainer for me to change what I was doing. So I think that would be the biggest contributing factor to how I've been stable for so long. But as I'm able, I learn more and I try new things and I try different things. And that includes Western medicine techniques too, you know? So I've had some procedures and some surgeries that, you know, most times it's because I have to. But I think food is a really big one, and vitamins and probiotics. When I learned about the nutrient deficiencies in the food we eat, and when I learned about gut health, that's a game changer. It really, really is. And if anybody takes the time to learn about gut health and the brain gut connection, it's vital to how your body functions. So, anything you can do to enhance that. So for example, essential oils help to maintain, there's hundreds of them, right? So there's different things, like there's one I use called Digesten that helps to, it's just a support for your digestive system to give it what it needs or the boost it needs to do what it's supposed to do. I take another one from time to time called, that's like a digestive enzyme that helps break down my food so I can get more nutrients from it. I use one that is formulated specific. It's a blend that, helps draw toxins out of the liver. I use a lot of citrus oils. Those do the same thing. They're very cleansing for your body. So I think I've dabbled in a lot. What I've settled on for now, is oils and food and vitamins and probiotics. And if it were more practical and cost effective, I would be juicing as well.
The juicing. If you had that, Magic Johnson money, you know, and
you're
not wrong. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, not everybody can afford. You know, we can't all sleep in a hyperbaric chamber and have a team of specialists on call at all times to help us. Right. We're kind of on our own, the rest of us. Yeah. I imagine, and you know, because you've battled this and continue to, and will continue to, you know, it's hard to really judge exactly, but I gotta imagine, man, you felt benefits, you know, across other areas, you know, just generally feeling better. I understand that you have something that you have to deal with on a regular basis, but, you know, all these other things I'm sure opened your eyes to, like, wow, man, this thing can help me in a lot of areas, my back pain, my neck pain, my headaches, my, you know, joints and so on.
Undoubtedly. So, I mean, I think, now I will say high quality essential oils, are not cost effective for everyone. For my family, we have decided that it is worth the sacrifice in some other areas for us to be using these essential oils, because not only do I benefit from them, but my entire family does. And so I use oils for headaches. I use oils for fevers. I use oils for backaches. I use oils for muscle cramps. I use oils for rashes. For one of my sons gets canker sores now and then. I use them for cuts and scrapes. I use them for they're my first defense. We have toothpaste and mouthwash and deodorant, like everything, and we use very very few chemicals in our home.
Yeah, I know, you know, we talked a little bit, you know, a few years back, I had reached out, you know, I wouldn't say I was a skeptic, you know, I'm open-minded, but, you know, like you kind of made reference to the snake oil before, and there's a lot of people who are skeptical about the essential oils. And I wouldn't say that I was a skeptic necessarily, but I wasn't knowledgeable either, right? And I was like, I was kind of on the fence, like, I don't know, maybe they work, maybe they don't. And, you know, there was a situation I actually reached out to a few people, and you were kind enough to get back to me. And, you know, I had a situation with my son where he had bronchial problems and was getting this cough all the time, man. And it was like, you know, he'd get 3 weeks off and then he's got a cough again for 6 weeks. And then he'd get, you know, a month off and then he's got a cough again for 6 weeks. And he's constantly dealing with this gnarly, like, wet, nasty cough all the time, right? And we had gone to the doctor, they give him medication, it goes away, and then it comes back again in a month, and then it goes away. And after a while, it's realized, like, hey, man, he's got a problem. Like, this isn't normal. This isn't just normal six-year-old illness stuff, you know what I mean? He didn't just catch this at school. He's got something further. And so we went to the doctor and then eventually went to a specialist and, you know, went through all the doctor visits and tests and everything, and what they came back with was, you know, your son has asthma. And, you know, it may go away, it may not. This is maybe something he's going to have to deal with for the rest of his life, but that's what's causing these coughs. And so, okay, you know, you're the doctor and you ran tests and, you know, I paid my copays and I assume you did something with that money and I assume you know what you're talking about. But, you know, when you're telling me my son's going to take these steroids and this medicine for an undisclosed amount of time, potentially the rest of his life, well, okay, I'm going to throw my challenge flag here. I'm going to ask some questions because I want to find out exactly what has been done. How certain are you? Now I'm not opposed to medicine. You know, if I break my leg, I'm going to the doctor. You know what I mean? I want you to take an X-ray, right? Like I need you guys for some stuff for sure. You know, if I tear an ACL, I'm going to need an MRI to confirm things, you know, right? I mean, you have machines that we just can't get at Walmart. So, and it has its place and absolutely, is necessary on occasion, but, felt to me like they were taking the easy way out, you know, and it's just like, well, this will probably work and it'll mask the symptoms. And, what I want to do is get to the root of the problem. What is causing this? And I know you're giving me something that's going to make him feel better. You're going to make it go away for now, but I want to make it go away forever. Is that an option? And when you and I talked, we had a nice long conversation and you had described that Alex had gone through something similar and, you know, you described what, had worked for him. You know, I'll say, so, that was, it was a long time ago, man. I don't remember, maybe 6 years ago, something like that, five, six years ago. And you know, my son was having this problem for like 2 years, and it was two puffs in the morning on this apparatus, and then two puffs before he goes to bed, and then this other thing that he takes with him to school to use as needed, and this was going to go on forever. And you gave us an alternative that may or may not work, you know, but it was much cleaner, and it wasn't going to have the side effects, and you know, it was natural as opposed to synthetic. It wasn't developed in a laboratory, you know, it's grown in on the earth. And okay, I like that better, you know. And so we gave it a shot, you know, we put it in a diffuser, and the breathe oil, you know, we put it on his chest, you know, kind of like you used to do with Vicks vapor rub, you know, and you kind of rub it around, and then we put it in a diffuser with a bunch of water, and he just sleep with it at night. And in 6 years, I can't say he's never had a cough again, but that whatever he had going on is gone for sure and has never come back. So I mean, he's gotten sick a couple times like we all do, but you know, it has not been that gnarly whooping cough thing that he was having before. And so in a very short order after giving that a run, and we didn't know, you know, I got the stuff from the doctor. I went to the drugstore and bought the stuff that my doctor's recommended also as a fallback, but turns out the essential oils worked. And so you know, it wasn't just a coincidence, man. The problems that my son was having for 2 years didn't just magically go away at the exact same time when I started using these essential oils. You know what I mean? That's too much of a coincidence for me. So, I mean, I was sold, and I've always believed in, just alternatives. I just bought a Shockey mat. So I have back problems. I got degenerated discs and arthritis, and I just lived a life of activity and construction, and I'm a little older now. And so I got a bad back, and, you know, I don't want to get fusion surgery. I don't want to be on opioids and grind through my life, right? I want to live a mostly healthy life. And so I'm always look. I believe in chiropractic as well. I don't use it as a regular like part of my regimen. You know, I use it when I need it, and then I don't go back for 6 months or 9 months or a year or whatever. But I do believe in it. I know it works because, again, this is more than just a coincidence. I can't have a problem for 5 weeks, go to a chiropractor, and then it just coincidentally stopped the next day, you know, or a couple of days later. Like, the chiropractic works, right? So I'm always looking for alternatives as well, you know, like, hey, you know, what's healthy? Like, this little Shockey mat, it hurts a little bit and it burns a little bit, but you know what? I feel better after I'm off of it, and it doesn't cost me anything, and doesn't cause any side effects, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And if it, you know, if it's effective, you can't really argue with it. And you know, you touched on something that's really important, which is that, you know, you have to have an open mind. And I also firmly believe that your mind has a lot of power. So, like, I mean, by my recollection, you were a bit of a skeptic, but you tried it because it was for your son. And yeah, I mean, you were surprised and thrilled by the results, and that's great. But if you go into something with the mindset of this isn't going to work, then it's probably not going to work, and you're going to be looking for all the reasons why it doesn't work. So keeping an open mind, I think so many times people are just, this is what you do. You go to the doctor, they give you medicine, you take it, and everything's fine. Well, there are other ways, and it's not easy. It is not easy. But
yeah, and like you said earlier in the conversation, you know, everybody's different and everybody's body's different, mm-hmm. and everyone's going to react differently. And, you know, I just think it's important to know that there are other options out there. And, you know, this one works for me. This is what I did. But, you know, here's option 2, 3, 4, and 5. You know, maybe number 3 works for you. I don't know, you know, but be open to trying and be honest, you know, give it an honest assessment. And, you know, take away the other variables where you can and kind of run a science experiment on yourself, really. I guess this is what you're doing, you know.
Yes, a little bit. But you'll know when you strike the right balance, because things will work, you know. And I think just knowing that even if you're not a person of faith, our bodies are made to work. Like, they're made to function. And if something's not functioning, it's because something is wrong. And so it's, you have to figure out what's wrong. And I think a lot of times, you know, I think some doctors are very well intended, And I think sometimes you do. You get the, I'm in a hurry, this is what you need, treatment. But you need to understand the root cause, because if you, you can put a Band-Aid all you want, but if you don't get stitches in that cut, it's not helping.
Yeah, and so, I think the way things are set up nowadays, we are issued our doctor. You know, you might only have one doctor mm-hmm. available in your area that's taking new patients, and you get who you get. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a history teacher that was pretty rough, and I thought I didn't like history at all, and I hated history. Well, it turns out I just didn't like my history teacher, you know, and I got a different one next year, and it turns out, wow, I like history quite a bit. And so you can get a doctor that you may or may not click with, and, you know, it's tough, man. I mean, the setup, the way we're set up here in America is, man, there's not a lot of flexibility when it comes to healthcare. You know, what you said about you're responsible for your health, that you need to own that and take it on. That's true, man. I mean, you are, you know, going to be given a doctor and, you know, they need to give you a referral if you're going to go see another guy. You know, it's up to them if you get to go see the specialist or not. You know, they decide whether you're wearing it or not. And so I just think the more you can do for yourself, the more you can educate yourself and at a minimum, at least know the right questions to ask. You know, go in there. Mm-hmm. No one's going to expect you to be a professional. You know, this guy did this for 8 years to learn this. I just started a couple months ago. So I know I don't know as much as you do, sir or ma'am, but here are my questions, and here's what I do know. Can you tell me where I'm wrong? You know, and I think that's on the individual to prepare themselves. And I agree with you wholeheartedly that I you know, sometimes I think the doctors are like they think of themselves as a different species. Sometimes it's like, man, you understand we're both humans here. Like, you know, I'm paying you to you know to do a service for me, but they don't always see it that way. They see like you know they're in charge and you're their subject, and it's like, no, not really. I mean, we're doing this together, right? Like, let's work together on this.
I do think
you're 100% right.
I do think that. Medicine is hopefully evolving into the model where they do see it as more of a partnership.
That's how I have been feeling, you know, in the more recent years in my doctoring is there's definitely a lot more openness. And I guess at the risk of offending somebody, what I'm seeing is the younger doctors tend to be a little bit more open to this, which is very logical because I feel, like I said earlier, there's a societal change in the mindset toward health and medicine and how health and medicine work together and, you know, the other options you have.
And I think that we are seeing that across a lot of things, not just medicine. And some of that is, you know, what did you learn when you were in school and you learned your profession? You know, and Chris and I talk a lot about sports, obviously, but even there, I mean, right, you're seeing, obviously, the coach in sporting is still tends to be in charge, but, and it's not going to be a free-for-all, but I do think that even many of the sports have evolved to where players have more of a say than they used to, and it's not just you know, the stand up and yell at everybody kind of mentality for a coach in all cases.
I hope that bleeds into other areas. You know, the work environment that I'm in is very team oriented. You know, we all have our roles, we all have our jobs and everything, but I think there's so much room in life for us to be a community. And, you know, not so much of a straight line, but more of a circle. You know, you're not the boss of me and I'm the boss of him and he's the boss of him. We're all together, you know, and the buck might stop somewhere and it might be someone who has the final say in a given matter. But I think there's a room all over in society for us to be, yeah, just more of a community, man, and understand that, you know, everyone's input matters and everyone should have a voice, you know. Especially the individual who's going to the doctor, who's we're talking about my body. You know, I definitely should have a say in my body, 100%, right?
Yeah, I think you should. And I think that, you know, Misty, you've clearly outlined, you know, the successes of that philosophy and, you know, what's worked for you and some models and ways to think about how others can be proactive and have that partnership with the medical people. I know I've had different doctors over my life, and those that resonate the most with me are those that, I mean, anybody who knows me knows I like to ask questions. And I like the doctors that are willing to let me ask them.
I agree. That's,
yeah, me too.
It's key. If you're not willing to answer my questions, and I don't think this is going to be a partnership that's going to work. And I've had doctors reject me.
Yeah, I've had the same thing, Misty. I had it, you know, and we both have children, and you know, while they're still a minor, you know, I kind of act as, you know, their voice. And man, sometimes, you know, hey, I'm asking questions here. I want to find out, you know, more. And it's like, well, I told you. And it's like, no, you told me something. You know what I mean? You told me what pill to go buy. I want to know why. What are the side effects? What is it it's going to do? How long is it going to last? You know, and it's like, you know, I've definitely gotten the annoyed, rolled-eyed look more than once, but I don't really care. I don't.
Yep. Oddly enough, for me, it was a pediatrician also that said, I can't be your doctor. Okay, that's fine. I'll find somebody else.
Again, this started for you when you were 19. It sounds like you've had quite a journey, points when you've been sicker than you are today. Where would you say you are with this situation at 43? You're off the transplant list, you said, correct?
Yes.
So where are you in this journey today, would you say?
I would say that is the question, right? That's it's a variable because, you know, like when I got that infection in the fluid, that came out of nowhere. And so really there's a potential for something like that to happen at any time. I am on medication now to prevent it from happening again. I don't like it, but I recognize that was a really, that set off a whole lot of other stuff. And so I'm willing to take a medication to deal with that. But barring any unforeseen circumstances, I guess you could say, I'm good. I feel like I'm pretty stable. You know, I have labs. I just had some labs done and my MELD is at 8. And like I said, I can do most everything I would want to do. And I, outside of fatigue and just, you know, the fluid gets old, outside of those couple things, like I think I feel good. I've been told that I probably don't. You know, they say that when you have a transplant, the person who received the liver wakes up from the surgery feeling like $1 million, and the donor, if it's a living donor, they feel like they were hit by a truck. So I don't know, like, how other people feel on the inside. I think I feel fine. I think I'm doing great.
Misty, I want to thank you. Obviously, you're my niece, but I want to thank you for sharing this journey with our podcast listeners and being so open just to give a bit of a perspective on something that most of us don't have much direct experience with.
Absolutely. I'm open to share anytime. And if anybody were to, you know, contact you with questions or anything, I'm happy for you to forward my information. My viewpoint on it is, if what I've been through can help anybody in any way with anything, including something that's not liver disease, right, I'm an open book. You know, I believe that as a Christian, I believe that I have a purpose, and whatever it is, I don't know, God does. And if it helps somebody, even one person, deal with some kind of trouble, illness or disease or anything in their lives, then it's fine that I have it. It's worth it.